Hello, you are tuned in to Messing with Herbs with herbalists Monica Rood
and Nava Konigsberg.
And today we wanted to talk about it's fall in the garden and it's time to dig roots. Fall after the frost is usually the best time to dig roots of perennials and biennials because the frost has killed back the aerial portion of the plant and the energy is now in the roots. Did you want to talk about annuals and why we don't dig the roots of annuals?
So I think we talked about this on a previous show, but let's just review. There are three main growth patterns of plants. There are annuals, which are plants that you plant a little seed, it comes up, it makes flowers, makes seeds, dies, done, all in one season. Those plants don't have big root systems because they get what they need during the year from the roots that they have and from their leaves and photosynthesis, and they have no reason to store anything in the roots because they're dead. The second group are biennials, and those are plants that come up the first year but don't make flowers. They'll often make a little ring of close-to-the-ground leaves. And that first year, they just sort of grow, but then in the fall, they send their energy down into the roots, store food in the form of starches in their roots over the winter, and then the next year, they come back up again, make a flower stalk, and then they die. So those plants we could harvest during that winter between the first and the second year. So after the plant has sent its energy back down again, the leaves have sort of faded. Now those are a little hard to find sometimes because they don't have a stem to show you where they are. So those are plants that mullein is a good example of that one. Everybody knows that. It grows all over the place around here. It's got fuzzy leaves and sends up big flower stalks. We talked about those in our last show, a couple shows ago. And so those, after the leaves have died back in the fall, or started to die back, but before it sends up its flower stalk in the spring, is when you would harvest something like that. Perennials are plants that come back year after year. Their roots get larger every year, and they are sort of like a tree. They send up their energy in the spring up into the leaves and new growth, and then in the autumn, they send it back down again to be stored over the winter. And that's primarily, those are perennials, and every year they store more and more, and those roots we dig in the fall. So what we're talking about today are biennials and perennial plants that we're going to be digging.
And some specific examples of biennials, another one is burdock. So the first year it doesn't have a flower stalk. So they could be dug in the fall of the first year or during the winter or early spring before it does send up a flower stalk. And these roots aren't good for medicine after they send up that flower stalk because they're putting all of their root energy into the flower stalk and the root becomes rather woody and pithy and is not good medicine anymore. But perennials could actually be dug any time, but they are stronger during the fall, winter, and early spring before they start growth again. And again, the roots are what we're looking for on these plants because it stores food and energy in the form of starch and other constituents that we find medicinal. And some examples of that include echinacea, elecampane, comfrey, astragalus, yerba manza, valerian, licorice. Any of those could be dug at this time.
I spent a good part of yesterday digging dandelion roots.
Ah.
And, there's still enough leaf that I can see where they are, but they've started converting their sugars for the winter time. And the thing with dandelions, of course, is you never get the whole thing. So I dig down and get as much as I can, and then next year I'll get more because they'll come right up again from the roots. That's one of the things about digging a lot of these perennials is you don't have to kill the plant often. Some you do, but a lot of them either will come right back again. Comfrey, I don't think you could kill it if you tried. If you leave one little tiny bit in the ground, it's just going to come right back up again. And then some have sort of side roots that you can dig without getting the main part of the plant. So it doesn't have to mean destroying the whole plant in order to dig it.
So what did you do with the dandelion that you dug?
Well, I took the dandelion and I used your method of I poured hot water over it. Cleaned it off, poured hot water over it and let it steep for a while, and then strained it out and added some alcohol to it to preserve it. And now I've got a fall dandelion root.
Good. Did it turn milky?
It didn't turn too milky. It got a little creamy, like thick, but it didn't turn milky, no.
Good. Well, we're going to talk primarily today about astragalus and echinacea. I'm sure all of you have heard about echinacea. It's world famous, and there's been a lot of talk about it for many years. First, I'm going to talk about astragalus, which is less well known. It's actually a Chinese herb that is used. It's a good thing to take before you get sick, especially for people who commonly get several colds and flus each year. It's a way to stop doing that if you want to. And a lot of it has to do with stress, the effect of stress on the immune system. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the immune system and how it is affected by stress. We all know that we're under a lot of stress, but we all may not totally realize the effect of all the stress. And after I read this list, you will definitely feel stressed. These are just some of the things that a person can feel stressed about. We all have tension in relationships and at work, deadlines, peer pressure, commuting, trying to squeeze too many activities into the day, struggling to go to work, to look after the kids, to keep up with the laundry and the housework and the shopping and the cooking and walking the dog. Don't forget to pick up the laundry, get the prescription filled, keep the car repaired, take the kids to soccer, music, or dance lessons, meet with their teacher, and go to the gym. Then try to catch up, try to get ahead, try to do more with less, try to do it all. Stay up late, get up early, and sleep poorly in between. There is also the stress of illness, missing work, trying to catch up after missing work, breathing polluted air and drinking polluted water, eating food additives. Synthetic fragrances are in everything, including the garbage bags. We eat on the run. We eat fast food. We drink too much alcohol and smoke too much. We eat too much. We lack exercise. And we worry. We have pain. We have chronic illness. We take care of people who have pain or chronic illness. There's the stress of the radiation in our environment, food sensitivities, heavy metals. But even happy events like getting married, having a baby, graduation, or taking a new job are also extremely stressful. And these are all perceived the same way by the immune system. They're all seen as sources of stress. And when the immune system senses stress, a stress hormone is secreted called cortisol from the adrenal glands, in an effort to help the body cope with the stress. And the more stressed out we are, the higher the level of cortisol, which then suppresses immune function and depletes B vitamins, leaving the individual susceptible to colds and flu, sometimes allergies, and sometimes many times a year. In long-term stress, stress mechanisms are kept constantly functioning at maximum capacity. We're always on. And this can lead to adrenal fatigue, which results in less cortisol available to deal with the stress. Are you stressed yet?
I'm stressed just listening to you. My goodness.
They say that now 85% of all diseases are considered to be related to stress. So when you read statistics about the main things that people die of in this country, like cardiovascular disease and cancer, etc., 85% of those top ones are related to stress.
I think I'm going to leave now. I'm going to go lie on the couch and eat chocolates for the rest of the day.
Yeah, you're under too much stress here.
Putting on a radio show, you didn't put that in as one of the.
Well, there were a lot of things I didn't put on that list, but I think you got the point. There are a class of herbs called adaptogens. which can help us deal with stress by reducing our physical response to stress.
Here's another way to think about stress. We get our life force, you know, our energy for living our lives from food that we eat, from breathing, from getting enough sleep. That's sort of what gives us the energy to live. And you can sort of think of it like a bank account. And when you are dealing with stress, you are taking money out of the bank. And so, of course, the trick is to not bounce checks, right? This is one of the reasons that I have such a hard time with all of these energy drinks that have become so popular. They're sort of like having a credit card. They make you think that you've got more money in the bank than you actually do. And they actually can increase your stress levels and end up making you sicker because you're using up more of what you've got. And so it's always and all about balance. Everything in your body, there's a term called homeostasis, you know, which means balance, everything being in a balanced state. And that is what the body wants. And it wants it on a molecular level, but it's also something that we need to try to find in our lives on a daily basis. All of these things that you just mentioned, Monica, these aren't things people are going to not have happen to them. So it's not a matter of going and curling up under a rock. It's a matter of finding balance and making sure that you're taking care of the things that you can, that you're getting good food, that you're getting enough sleep, that you're trying to get good sources for your water and not ingest or be exposed to a lot of toxins, that you're keeping your stress at work or in relationships in perspective. It's all about balance. And I think that's our biggest challenge sometimes, is we get so caught up and so overwhelmed in everything.
We get stressed out trying to reduce
stress,
the stress.
Right. And, you know, here in the Southwest, we don't have that sort of hunker down for the winter. We have sunny days, we have cold days, and so our bodies don't fully shift into that winter slowed down metabolism mode. And so we kind of keep going on a level that people who live in colder climates don't. And so that can be a component of stress also, is that we don't have that downtime.
So when we take adaptogens, they help us deal with stress by keeping down, helping us so we don't respond as much to the stress physically, like our blood pressure doesn't go up as much, and stress hormones don't go up as much. And as a result, we feel calmer and less stressed. So one of these adaptogens is called astragalus. And it has a wide range of effects, but especially it helps to reduce that stressed out feeling. It is a tonic that helps the immune system, partly because it contains what we call polysaccharides, which is a certain kind of molecule that is supportive to the immune system. So it strengthens the immune system and makes the body less susceptible to colds and flus. And it helps the body defend itself rather than acting on a specific disease. So it helps the body to fight bacteria, infections, and it's also antioxidant, helps to protect the liver from damage from chemicals, pollution, etc. Other benefits can include helping to improve the blood, helping with anemia, help recovery from chemotherapy and radiation, and help us to feel more invigorated with more vital energy and increased stamina.
I think we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we will continue talking about astragalus and about the immune system and move on to echinacea. See you in a few minutes. And we're back with Messin' with Herbs with Monica Rood and Nava Konigsberg. And we've been talking about fall root digging and specifically about the herb astragalus. And Monica, when we were here before, you were talking about all the uses of it. But could you tell us a bit about how to dig it, what to do with it once you've dug it, and how to use it and take it and all that good stuff?
So astragalus is usually grown for 2 to 3 years before it's harvested, and it is the root part that is used. It's a taproot type root, which means it's kind of like a carrot. So it goes down really deep, and it can be pretty gnarly to dig up depending on how long it's been in that spot and how happy it's been.
So does that mean you have to kill it in order to get it? to get the root?
I don't know. I actually have never tried to save part of it because I grow several plants and there's no point in trying to save it.
So you just kind of stagger your growing of it. You'll plant some and then the next year you'll plant more, and so that
right.
every
or
year
each
there's
year I just harvest the biggest, fattest ones and leave the others to grow bigger. But you probably could just cut part of it off if you only had one plant and you didn't want to kill it.
So even though, I just want to clarify that even though we're talking about astragalus, a lot of things we're talking about in terms of cultivation and preparation of root plants, of root herbs, are going to be universal to whatever plant you happen to be digging, dandelion or burdock or
right.
any
with
of them.
Most, a lot of herbs, you don't have to worry about whether you're killing the plant or not because you have a whole patch of them. And you're going to keep the patch going. They often, like valerian, reseeds itself all over the place, so you never have to worry about not having more of that for next year. And it's not that big a plant. So with some plants, it's not that practical to try to not to kill the plant. It just depends on what it is. But astragalus makes a pretty big root, and it can be dried. You want to chop it up into pretty small pieces before you try to dry it, because it's going to be harder to cut up after it's, like if you dried it whole. And then it can be made into a tincture, but it's mostly made into a decoction, which to do it, make a decoction, you take a couple of teaspoons of the dried cut up root and add it to 12 ounces of water and simmer for 20 to 30 minutes and then let it steep for a half hour and drink 2 or 3 cups of that a day. If it's used as a tincture, usually 40 to 80 drops are taken in a little bit of tea or water 3 times a day. If you don't grow it yourself, which I understand everybody doesn't, you can buy it in the herb store or sometimes in a health food store, either as a dried root that's cut up into little pieces or in capsules, or a tincture, or sometimes in these dried slices that look like tongue depressors.
If you do want to grow it, is it an attractive plant? Is it something you'd want in your garden? Like, where would you put it in the garden?
I'd put it in the back where you're not necessarily going to see it. It's not a real ornamental
plant.
It's
kind of scraggly and rangy.
It's kind of a scraggly legume-type looking plant, and it does get some cute little yellow flowers on it, but it's not very ornamental or eye-catching in the garden. So it's one of those you can tuck in the back corner.
Does it need sun or shade?
Full
or
sun.
Water?
Lots of water.
Lots of water. Good thing we have plenty of that here in the Southwest.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as bad in needing water as a lot of other plants. But and it can also be added to soups. It's actually a pretty tasty root, and you can just put pieces of the root or one of those tongue depressor looking pieces into soup, especially a brothy kind of soup.
So if it's fresh, can you eat it, just eat it like a vegetable, or is it
well,
too woody?
It's very fibrous. Mm-hmm. So it's best made into a tea or a soup stock.
So you sort of soak it in the soup water and
right.
let it cook for a while and then pull it back out again.
Right, you don't really eat it.
Okay.
You're really just getting the flavor and the nutrients into your soup. It's kind of like bay leaves, but better. You know, more nutritious, really. So it has a pretty good flavor when it's adding to soup. But another thing I wanted to say about astragalus is it's generally used before you get sick. It's used to just strengthen the immune system so you don't get sick as often, and if you do get sick, the illness doesn't last as long. And it's generally not used during an acute illness or infection, like flu and bronchitis or pneumonia, because it can drive the illness deeper into the body. And the other thing that really helps at this time of year is to just provide for yourself more rest and downtime. That's one of the best things you can do for your immune system, in addition to eating properly. You know, take your vitamins, eat your greens, eat your nettles, drink your herb tea, and take astragalus.
I just want to clarify about this concept of driving a sickness deeper into your body, and because that can be a little confusing concept to people. The way that I envision it, and maybe you have a different way of explaining it, but I'll do my best, is if you imagine that you've got this inner core of life force. Sometimes the word that's used is chi. It's not a direct translation, but that's the word that's what's come to mean here in the States anyway. It's a Chinese word. And so you've got this sort of inner pillar of your life force. And when you are fighting off an illness, a virus or a bacteria, your body is doing everything it can to push energy out, right? You cough out, you sneeze, you sweat, you throw up, you have diarrhea. Your body is doing everything to push it away, send everything out. Astragalus and other tonic herbs like this are things that are sending energy inward to that inner core, which you want to be strong so that when you need it to push out, it's able to do that. So I have people take astragalus when they're not sick and they're not about to get sick. They're basically feeling okay, but they're under a lot of stress. People who are often exposed to illness, teachers of small children who are always coming down with stuff, people who are older, whose immune systems might be a little more compromised. So I have people take things like astragalus and other immune support herbs, and we're going to distinguish, and we're going to talk about this more when we talk about echinacea, as distinguished from immunostimulating herbs. These immunosupportive herbs, in the long run, support the immune system, but are not the things that you take right when you're about to get sick. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
In contrast to immunostimulants, things like echinacea, which we're going to talk about in a few moments. So the immune system is really complicated and incredibly fascinated and complex. And scientists are constantly learning more and more about it. And I won't even pretend that I understand a fraction of it. And so we're going to be talking about this in really broad terms, and anyone out there who's an immunologist, please don't hold me to any of this. I'm gonna do my best to try to explain the difference between the concepts of an immunomodulator, an immunotonic, and immunostimulant. An immunotonic is what we were just talking about with astragalus. It's something that supports normal immune function. And what does that mean, normal immune function? When you are exposed to a disease, to a pathogen, to a bug, to a virus or a bacteria, your immune system's job is to fight it off. And it goes through a whole series of very complex processes in order to do that. And when you catch a cold, the thing that's making you miserable isn't actually the cold virus. It's your body's response to it. I was talking before about trying to push energy outward. You produce mucus in order to trap it and carry it out. You may get a fever. All of these things happen when your body is fighting off sickness, and it's your own immune system that's doing it. And it's your immune system's job to know this is a bad guy. This is something we want to fight off. It's worth making ourselves miserable for a little while so that we can kill this thing off. And immunostimulants are herbs or substances that tell that immune system, come on, get out there and fight that infection off and do what you need to do. Remember that a component of the immune system and of the immune response is inflammation. And inflammation has been getting lots of attention lately because it's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, if you're out in the woods and you break your ankle and your ankle swells up with inflammation, that inflammation is keeping your foot immobile. It's serving a purpose. And the pain from it is important so that you don't go walking around on your broken ankle. On the other hand, and I don't know if we're just more is happening because of other factors in the world or we're just noticing it more, long-term inflammation can be a factor in many diseases. In fact, what scientists are saying now is that in terms of heart disease and cardiovascular disease, that inflammation is as much or more of a health risk as your cholesterol levels. So why would your body do this? Why would it create something that is bad for you? And I guess the answer is that there, as I said, there's a component of inflammation that is useful and helpful. There are components of it that are not as useful and helpful. We don't really know why those exist. They must serve some purpose. The body's usually pretty good at knowing what to do. And it may be that it's the long-term chronic inflammation that is such a problem. So an immunostimulant may not be appropriate if someone has an autoimmune disease, for example, someone whose immune system is already overreacting. So what happens in an autoimmune disease? With autoimmune disease and with an allergy, your immune system, whose primary job is to say, well, what's me and what's not me? And then its secondary job is to say, okay, of the things that aren't me, which things are bad, like a cold virus, and which things are really not a big deal, like a piece of pollen. And when you have an allergy, your body isn't able to say, oh, that's just pollen, it's not bad, I don't really need to mount a defense against it. And instead, your immune system gets a little freaked out and starts attacking it as if it was a virus or a bacteria. With autoimmune disease, it's even more serious, because rather than just attacking a foreign object, your body, for whatever reason, begins attacking itself. And that is, I think we can all agree, an extremely inappropriate immune response. And there's lots of theories about why that happens, from a low-grade virus, what we call a retrovirus, a virus that you maybe had as a child and it went dormant inside your body and it's kind of still there lurking around, and so your immune system never gets to relax fully because it knows something's there, so it's always sort of on alert. So that's one of the theories that's been put out. Certainly everything from environmental factors and things in our food, vaccinations, all kinds of things that no one really knows. There's definitely seems to be a hereditary component both to autoimmune and to allergies. The tendency to have allergies or to have autoimmune diseases is more hereditary than the specific allergy or the specific autoimmune disease. But so an immunomodulator, something like astragalus, an immunotonic, it's not stimulating the immune system. It's not saying, hey, come on there, little immune system, get out there and fight. It's simply helping, and again, we don't know how, it's helping to nourish and support the immune system so that when something does come along and you need to fight it, your immune system is primed and ready to do it. And some of the ways that some of these immunomodulators work are simply by helping to alleviate stress. A hot bath could be an immunomodulator. Mm-hmm. Anything that sort of gets your immune system where it needs to be so that you are having an appropriate response, fighting against the things you need to fight against and not fighting against the things that you don't need to fight against. Do you want to add anything about tonics?
No, I'm speechless after that dissertation.
Well, this is, I really know so little about it. I'd love to take an immunology class about it, and I'm sure some of our listeners may have more to add than that. But that's the basic idea. And so the thing to remember is you want to take an immunosupport, immunotonic. And again, the word tonic is always going to mean safe, long-term use. Something, almost think of it more as a vitamin. Whenever we use the word tonic, something that tonifies, something that nourishes and supports. So you want to take an immunotonic, like astragalus, when you're basically feeling okay, but you may be exposed to stress and you want to prepare yourself for the future. You want to take an immunostimulant when you are in dire straits and you know, oh boy, I'm about to come down with something. And sometimes a few hours can make a huge difference. I always tell people, when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning with a scratchy throat and feeling like you want to crawl out of your skin and thinking, oh, am I going to be sick in the morning? Well, gee, maybe I'll just wait till the morning, and if I'm sick, then I'll do something about it. Get up then. Get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Make yourself a hot cup of tea. Put whatever herbs you're going to do. Take some vitamin C. Take a hot bath or shower, and then go back to bed. Because it's a lot easier to head something off at the pass. As I said before, once you are sick, what's making you miserable is your body's immune response to it. If you can head it off at the pass and not have to get that immune response so strong, then you won't be You won't have all of the symptoms. We're going to be back in a moment and continue talking about echinacea.
We are back. We're still here messing with herbs with Monica Root and Nava Koningsberg. And we were talking about echinacea, and you know, there's been a lot of studies done about echinacea that are very confusing and contradictory. And what have you found out about any of those?
Echinacea is probably the most studied herb that there is. And yes, it is very controversial. When you do a study, well, these studies that are done on it, people, they would do studies and give it to people or do it in a Petri dish, I don't even know how, and some of them would find that it was effective and some of them would find that it wasn't effective. And the question that we have to ask in evaluating these studies is, well, how was it used? One of the things about echinacea is it needs to be used in high doses at the very, as we were talking about, that 3 o'clock in the morning, you wake up. Once you're sick, you're still going to be miserable even if you take the echinacea. It does not give symptomatic relief.
It's not a silver bullet.
It's not a silver bullet. Believe me, if we had the cure for the common cold, we wouldn't be here. I'd be lying on my yacht somewhere with all my millions. Somebody would anyway. So we have to, when we hear about all of these studies, we sort of have to, to me, I am a traditional herbalist, and I look at thousands of years of human use versus questionable studies. First of all, you have to ask, well, who paid for the studies? Was it the pharmaceutical industry, who may or may not have a vested interest in the success of a particular study? Second of all, was traditional use incorporated into the way that they set up the study? So for example, if, like with echinacea, it's used high doses early on, is that how they used it? There are different species that I'm going to talk about, different parts of the herbs that are used. How did they prepare it? All of these questions have to be answered before we can even begin to look at the studies and say, yes, this was a good study or a bad study. I personally use it and all the time for heading things off, as I was discussing before. So Western medicine doesn't give a lot of credence to anecdotal evidence, and yet when enough of that piles up, to me, that seems as valid as these, again, sometimes questionable laboratory tests. That having been said, one thing that everyone does agree on is that it's, with a few exceptions, pretty safe. So as long as, and we'll talk about those exceptions because they're important to understanding how echinacea works later on. So again, I'm a traditional herbalist and I tend to give a little more credence, or at least equal credence, to how things have been used traditionally. So let's talk about echinacea a little bit. There are about 9 different species. They are actually native to this part of the world, to North America and southern Canada. Of the 9, there are 3, really 2, that are primarily used medicinally here, everywhere actually. One of them is Echinacea purpurea, and the other one is Echinacea angustifolia. And if you have a pretty purple coneflower growing in your garden, it is most likely Echinacea purpurea. That is the more ornamental one, and it's the one that's sold by nurseries, and it's, many people have it growing in their garden just because it's a pretty flower.
And is easier to grow.
And is much easier to grow. The angustifolia, which is more of a plains plant, I have not had good success personally. Do you have it growing?
I don't have any growing right now, but I have grown it in the past. And I think the reason it's difficult is because people like to water plants. And the angustifolia species doesn't need as much water. And
yeah,
it's easy
to rot out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Overwater it.
I've had a hard time getting it to germinate also. The thing about the angustifolia is it does seem to be the species of choice in medicine use, and because it's hard to grow, it has almost been wiped out in the wild. And this kind of brings up a really important issue that we should talk about, which is the ethical use of wild plants. You know, plants that are not really available to be grown on farms, that can only be gathered in the wild, We have a huge responsibility to maintain those populations. Years ago, I read a book that was written in 1910 about a man who harvested herbs, and he's listing all of the herbs that he harvests, and he's talking about different ones going almost extinct, like ginseng and echinacea. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, if they were almost extinct in 1910, how do they even exist in the wild now at all? And then I realized, of course, that it was because drugs were invented and people stopped harvesting the herbs. And so that's the real benefit of drugs, is that they took some of the pressure off of the wild populations of plants. That's a joke, everyone. So it is important that, right, what's been going on lately in the industry is people just go out and they harvest the echinacea and they dig up the whole plant and they don't care about killing the plant. There is Echinacea angustifolia available that has been grown on farms, and you should only purchase organically grown echinacea. If it says wildcrafted, it's an endangered species, and you should not. I don't work with that plant at all. The Native Americans used echinacea extensively. There's history going back a long way. They used it for all sorts of things, from snake bites, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later, to as a cough medicine, for sore throats. One of the neat things about echinacea is that in addition to its immunostimulating properties, if you taste it, it makes your mouth go numb, which can be very useful if you've got a toothache or irritated mouth or a sore throat. So you're sort of taking care of two things at once, helping fight off and boost your immune system to fight off the infection and giving yourself a little relief at the same time.
So locally it has a numbing effect.
Yes, it can numb out your mouth. The Europeans were turned onto it by the native people here, and we have records of it all the way back to 1762 was the earliest written record of it being used. But it was very, very common in American medicine. Remember that until about the 1930s, regular doctors used herbs all the time. So there's lots and lots of records available of the use of echinacea and many other herbs also. So it was an important herb used by the eclectic doctors, that was one particular group of doctors up until the 1830s. And they used it for all kinds of things, from inflammatory skin conditions, syphilis. You know, one could argue that the entire history of Western medicine comes down to trying to find a cure for syphilis. Many, many things. It was pretty common. Typhus, diphtheria, tuberculosis even. However, when antibiotics became more popular, that was really the beginning of the end for a lot of these herbs. That was when a lot of people just started switching to antibiotics. Although they remained officially part of what's called the National Formulary, which means the official list of drug plants and pharmaceutical preparations, up until the late 40s. And the people who kept it going, really, were the Germans. They never stopped researching. And there has probably been more research done in Germany on herbs in general, but on echinacea in particular. They just kind of picked up where the Americans left off, and they've been studying it ever since. And it is, as I said, one of the most highly studied herbs. And it is probably next to something like chamomile or mint in terms of the really stronger medicinal herbs. It is the most popular one. It's the one that the most people have heard of. A survey I was looking online, and I apologize to whoever's website I stole this little piece of information from, but 40% of adults surveyed in 2002 reported that they had taken echinacea sometime in the past year. It's a huge number. Yeah, it's a lot of people. And in Germany, I think this is from the same website, over 200 products made from echinacea are available.
Wow.
Mostly what people use it for is to try to prevent or treat colds and flus, viruses. And traditionally, the root was what was used. However, the flowers, particularly if you look at the flower, it's a really neat looking flower. If you sort of imagine a daisy with its petals drooping down, but large and purplish, and then in the center there's this little spiky hard cone where the seeds develop. The cone has lots of medicinal properties in it also, as does the entire plant, the leaves, everything. And again, going back to this issue of not wanting to waste plant material, especially plants that are potentially endangered, I now use the whole plant. The leafy part is a lot easier to make a tea out of. And when I'm making my extracts, I combine both root and flowers and try to get all of that, the whole plant energy into it.
It's not unusual to find combinations of different types of, different varieties of echinacea and different parts, like the flowers and the roots, or the purpurea species as well as the angustifolia species.
Yeah,
I mean, they all work.
They do, and I personally, I make a combination of the echinacea angustifolia root. The purpurea doesn't have a lot of root as part of it. It's kind of got a spindlier root than the angustifolia. So I tend to use the root of the angustifolia and the flowers and top part of the purpurea because I have access to those in my garden. So how does it work? What does it do? That's really the confusing part. And it honestly, despite all of these hundreds of studies for all of these years, no one really totally understands how it works. And part of the reason we don't understand how it works is because, again, going back to what we spoke to in the last session, we don't understand how the immune system works.
Right.
So how can we understand something that works on the immune system? But what has come out of the studies is the concept that echinacea enhances non-specific immunity. What does that mean? It means that rather than being used against a particular bug. So if you take an antibiotic, there are different types of antibiotics and each one of them kills a different type of bacteria. Rather than doing that, it enhances, increases, stimulates immunity in general to help fight off infection.
So it's more like a broad spectrum antibiotic.
Well, and even calling it an antibiotic is something that will is
a
little
more broad spectrum as opposed to a specific bacteria.
Exactly. And when we come back in a moment, we will continue to explore that. And we're back with Messing with Herbs. We're talking about echinacea. And during the break, Monica was saying, wait a minute, what are you talking about? I use purpurea root all the time. And I was saying that I don't have a lot of it growing in my garden, but you use it and you're happy using it?
Yes, I use the flowers, the seeds, and the root specifically. And if it grows for 3 years or more, it has a pretty significant root. It's a different kind of root than the angustifolia. It's more of a skinny little lateral, like pieces of spaghetti, not as deep, whereas the echinacea angustifolia is more of a taproot, but you have to grow it longer, like at least 4 or 5 years before it's big enough to make it worthwhile to harvest. But I think the purpurea root is perfectly strong and useful, and it's good to go as far as I'm concerned. So you can see there's lots of controversy, even amongst two herbalists who work together, about which echinacea species are better and which ones are easier to grow and use.
So now that that's not settled. Let's get back. We were talking about echinacea and how it works, its mechanism of action. And just to reiterate, an antibiotic, for example, directly kills a bacteria. Echinacea does not directly kill bacteria. It does two things. It stimulates our own immune system to be more efficient, to fight off not just bacteria, but viruses and abnormal cells that come up, any sort of thing. And remember, antibiotics are not useful against viruses. They're only useful against bacteria. And it does have an antibacterial component to it, but not by directly killing the bacteria. What it does is actually kind of neat. There is an enzyme that the bacteria have on them that allows them to sort of latch onto and attach and get into a cell. And the echinacea seems to inhibit that enzyme so that you've got the bacteria, but they can't actually get to your cell to do damage to it, which is a kind of a different approach than the antibiotics use. So we were talking before, we were talking about astragalus, we were talking about the difference between an immunotonic, an immunomodulator, and an immunostimulant. Echinacea is definitely, again, another controversy. Is it an immunostimulant or is it an immunomodulator? The camp that says it's an immunostimulant says, well, look, it stimulates lymphocytes. It actually, if you go to the doctor and you've been taking echinacea and you get a blood test, they may come back and tell you that you've got a high white blood cell count, and they may be concerned about it. So you need to tell your doctor that you've been taking it, and that if they don't know, echinacea increases your white blood cell levels, because it's
which are lymphocytes, which are
the things that are part of your immune system that are fighting off and actually getting at all of these pathogens. So it definitely does all of that. On the other hand, it also has anti-inflammatory properties and has been successfully used for all kinds of inflammatory conditions, including inflammatory skin conditions. It's got a history of being used topically for that. So how can that be? How can it both stimulate the immune system and at the same time calm down the immune system? And again, this gets back to that whole conversation about the immune system, that it, because the immune system has both inflammatory and anti-inflammatory components to itself, and we don't fully understand them. Now, the reason that this is important and the reason it's so controversial is because in people who have autoimmune disease or allergies, it may not be appropriate to give them something that is going to stimulate their immune system. Remember, their immune systems are already freaking out and overreacting and acting inappropriately. So why would we want to say to the immune system, come on and get more active and more excited? And so there is huge controversy about, you were telling me about being on a chat with other herbalists and how everybody was just talking about that, weren't you?
Yes, there were several dozen herbalists on this blog, and they were discussing whether echinacea should be used in autoimmune disease, and there was no agreement at all, none. Some felt that it was too stimulating, but others did use it for infections for people who have autoimmune disease. So
there for was short-term totally, use.
Right, there was totally no agreement at all.
So this is something that, you know, if you are someone who has one of these conditions, you certainly want to do more research, talk to someone knowledgeable, and make the best decision that you can before deciding to use something like echinacea. I tend to not recommend echinacea to people with autoimmune or allergies, just to be on the safe side, and I'll wait till the jury comes back in before.
Yes, and speaking of allergies, if people know that they have an allergy to plants in the daisy family, then they should use echinacea cautiously, because they might also be allergic to echinacea.
So echinacea also, in addition to these, has a few other kind of neat properties. One, as I mentioned before, is that it's numbing to the mouth, so it's a great one if you've got a mouth infection or a sore throat or anything like that. As I also mentioned, it can be used for against inflammation in the skin. Another use for it is traditionally it was used for snake bites. And the rattlesnakes that live here in the Southwest, there are two different types with two different types of venom. One of them has neurotoxin and the other has a necrotizing factor, meaning flesh eating. And before I go any farther, let me first disclaim and say, if you are bitten by a rattlesnake, seek proper medical attention immediately. Anything I'm about to say is in no way, shape, or form meant to suggest that you should replace getting to the hospital and taking whatever other precautions you can. Rattlesnake bites are very serious, especially in younger people or elderly people, and depending on where you get bitten is how quickly it can travel. And since you probably were too busy screaming and running away to notice what type of snake bit you and what type of toxin it has, get to the hospital. Having said all that, with the type of snake venom that is the flesh-eating kind, and this is also useful for any kind of venom where the flesh is dying off, and so like a brown recluse bite, echinacea, along with other herbs, seems to really, really be useful in getting that tissue to stop degenerating. And this is one of the cases where when I'm dealing with snake bite, I use prickly pear, which is the cactus that everyone's seen around here. It's that flat padded cactus. And that inner gel of it is hydrophilic, meaning it pulls water. And so if you put it on a boil or on an insect bite or on a snake bite or any situation where there's infection, fluid, pus, poison, it will pull it out better than anything. You know, some we use honey, we use clay, we use herbs, we use all kinds of things for pulling out of the body. But to me, the prickly pear, hands down, is absolutely the best. Now, of course, you want to make sure you get all the prickers off of it before you use it. And you can either just take a pad, scrape off the spines, singe off the little hairs that you tend not to see, the glaucids, and then cut a piece and put it right on the area. Or you can scrape out the goo and sort of glom it on there and wrap it on with a gauze.
And this is known as a poultice.
Yes.
When you use herbs this way.
Yes. And so if you are bitten by something that is venomous and you've already been to the hospital, you've already gotten whatever care you're going to get there, but the tissue is continuing to necrotize, continuing to die off, you use the prickly pear, you put it on, and it will pull the poison out, it will pull the infection out, and it will also leave the area a little more open. And then at that point, you can use echinacea topically and high doses internally to fight off the necrotization. And to talk about how safe echinacea is, the traditional dose, this is, again, how it was used traditionally, the traditional dose, if you're bitten by a snake, of echinacea is 1 drop per pound of body weight per hour. So if you weigh 120 pounds, you would take 120 drops of extract every hour.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is a lot. But again, as long as you don't have another condition that precludes you from taking echinacea, it is totally safe in those doses. And I usually tell people, just drink the whole bottle on the way to the hospital, and you'll be fine. Your mouth might be a little numb, but you won't care by that point. So again, taking echinacea, if you're taking it to fight off infection, then the best way to do it is at the very first sign that you're getting sick. If you take it when you're already sick, it can be helpful, but you're not going to notice because you're still going to be miserable and have all of the same symptoms. It is available in lots of different forms. You can get it in an extract. You can make a decoction of the root. You can make a tea of the upper parts of the plant. There are capsules available. I don't know, Monica. I'm not a big fan of capsules in general or tablets. What do you think about
that?
Well,
one of the things about capsules is the herb has to be ground up to be put in a capsule, and you never really know how long ago that herb was ground up and put in that capsule, and so it tends to deteriorate faster as opposed to a tincture, which lasts pretty much indefinitely and tends to be stronger. And especially if you get really cheaply, if echinacea capsules are cheap, maybe it's not a good quality herb. But also the herb, dried herb, needs to be stored in a dry, cool place and used within just a year or so of when you harvested it for it to be potent.
And the other thing about capsules is when you take a capsule, first you have to digest the capsule, then you have to digest the herb, whereas when you have a tea or an extract, the herb's already basically digested. It's already been extracted, and all your body has to do is sort of suck it up. Absorb it, right? You don't have to go through that whole process of taking it in. And you'd need an awful lot of echinacea capsules in order to
get 120 drops a pound.
Right. Herbs. Certainly not what you... So, again, echinacea has a really, really good safety record. And for most people, there is no problem and there is no known toxicity. However, there are these few indications. Again, if you are dealing with autoimmune disease, which includes HIV, you definitely want to know that it's very controversial to use it. Again, also in allergies, particularly allergies to the daisy family. It is used in pregnancy. It is one of the few herbs that is okay to use after the first trimester of pregnancy if you're coming down with something. So that's a good thing, and also when you're breastfeeding. So that's nice to know. And you can give it to small children. Again, it might make their tongues a little numb, but you can find a form that doesn't have alcohol in it.
Or you can mix it with water or tea, and then it's not numbing to the tongue so much.
And so that's the deal with echinacea.
Sounds good to me. I'm going to go take some right now. I've been feeling down.
Having said all of that, echinacea is traditionally given to small children. You need to find a way to give it to them that they will take. It can have that tingly effect on their mouth, and some kids don't like that. But if you mix it in with water or juice or tea or something, that usually mitigates that problem. Again, it's not toxic, so dosage will be by weight, and when you get it or make it, you can talk to a healthcare practitioner about appropriate dosage. It is traditionally, it is used during pregnancy and during nursing. Pregnancy, I don't really feel comfortable giving women anything if I can help it before the end of the first 12 weeks, the first trimester. But after that, I do, if a woman's coming down with something, being sick when you're pregnant is neither fun nor great for yourself or the baby. So I do give women echinacea at that point. And the other nice thing about it is that unless you're on medications that are specifically doing something to the immune system, like immunosuppressant drugs or something like that, it is, which would be another contraindication, by the way, if you're on immunosuppressant drugs, you would not want to take an herb that's an immunostimulant. But other than that, with most medications, it is pretty safe. Again, seek some information about that before you start taking it.
Well, that's what we have to say today about echinacea and the immune system. I just want to remind our listeners that herbs are not really intended to prevent, diagnose, or cure any medical conditions. So if you are sick, please check in with your health practitioner or talk to an herbalist. See you next time.